Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, antitrust and big tech. And Richard, big hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday with some of the biggest names in tech, the heads of Google, Apple, Amazon, and Facebook, all testifying before the Antitrust Subcommittee of House Judiciary. And this comes at a time when the Trump administration is talking about taking antitrust measures against some of these companies. This is the environment that these CEOs are walking into or zooming into, as the case may have been. So why don't we start with this? None of those companies that I just mentioned are monopolists in the traditional use of the term. There are other search engines besides Google. There are other online retailers besides Amazon. There are other social networks besides Facebook. But the argument goes, the old definitions of monopoly applied to a brick and mortar world, but in a bytes world, it's about the incredible economies of scale, the incredible network effect. So for instance, you can start a rival to Facebook, but the whole appeal of Facebook is that you can find almost everyone there, that you don't have to toggle across a half dozen social networks to find all of your friends. And that, in this argument, makes them akin to what economists would call natural monopolies, situations where the very nature of the market tends towards consolidation. And that, in the critics' telling, is why they have to be brought to heel under the anti-monopoly laws. How do you see the matter?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I would mention is somewhat, shall we say, orthogonal to what you said. Every one of these companies is new, right? They're all basically a generation old. And what they've been able to do is essentially push aside, in terms of public influence and market capitalization, everybody else. And why is it they're able to do that? Because what you talk about is a platform economy or as a network industry, where in effect it's not only that it costs you very little to add any individual person to the network, but the value to any person on a network depends upon the number of people on that network, and the greater the number, the happier the crowd. What they've done is they've managed to achieve a huge amount of social welfare. So the first point to note is they're all quite different. Bezos does not run an Amazon. He's not running a network industry. Facebook is a network industry. It turns out that Apple has some network characteristics, and Google is not really a network industry in the same sense. So they all actually have somewhat different market niches, and you have to be careful about it. But what each of them is able to do is to take advantages of economies of scale, which produces down price. And so one of the things you want to do is to look at the kind of net worth. And I think one of the people, many people have said, well, look, you know, Bezos and Zuckerberg are two of the richest people on the face of the globe. And it's certainly not inherited wealth. They both came up from nothing. There is a kind of a maxim that takes place in this particular area, which tries to figure out what the wealth of a founder is, and then compare that to the social value that is created, which is a combination of the value for all the employees who get early shares in these companies and all the consumers. And the most that you can credit to one of these characters is they get 10% of the wealth that they create, which means that if you get a guy who's worth $100 billion, he's created at least $1 trillion of wealth for everybody else. And so the first thing that should be said when you bring them up there is you say, I wish to thank you. The amount of consumer surplus and labor surplus that you've created has been simply enormous. What we have to do first is to recognize the great achievements that you have in terms of managing to provide novel markets that nobody else has been able to serve with a loyal consumer base and so forth. And now what we have to do is we have to ask the following question. If the good things that you take us from 1 to 100, we have to ask whether there's sort of bad things that take us down from 100 to 90. And what happens in these particular hearings, which makes them, to my mind, so inappropriate, is what they do is they assume all the good stuff is there like manna from heaven, and the only thing they start asking about is the bad stuff. So when you ask a question of Jeff Bezos, it says, you know, there's this woman who claimed that she had been squeezed. Well, she may or may not have been squeezed, but you're talking about a company which has hundreds of thousands of suppliers that manage to sell most of their products over Amazon. And the thought that there's going to be some person who's been mistreated or some goods that turn out to miss the warranty associated with them is not a function of any venality. It's a function of the law of large numbers. And so what always troubles me about these guys prizes. You put them up there. They are, in some cases, genuine geniuses, the guys who do the founding, and they're certainly very considerable individuals like Cook and Pichai, Sundar, who essentially take over mature companies and so forth. And they treat them as though somehow or other they're a set of hooligans on the one hand, the thieves on the other. And that's the way the hearings started to begin. Everything turns out to be a form of theft. And I think that this is simply just the worst form of ingratitude. We should be extraordinarily for them. That doesn't mean they don't commit antitrust violations, privacy violations, and so forth. But there's a big difference in the way in which you approach this. These hearings were meant to be existential. Why is it that you guys even exist? Whereas the proper situation is you guys have done an enormous amount of good, but like everybody else, you're a mixture of nine parts good and one part bad. And what we have to do is to figure out whether there's some kind of practices that you engage in that ought to require some greater scrutiny. It would be very odd that everybody else in the economy is going to be subject to regulation and you should be entirely free from it. And at that point, what you do is you give a little bit of acknowledgement and then you're going to have a serious discussion. But all they did is to put these guys in a defensive process. And there isn't a single man on that committee, a single woman on that committee who's done a 1/100th of the amount of social benefit that any one of these four people have created. And these are people about whom you know I'm quite critical about in individual circumstances. But that's not the issue. They were trying to go for the jugular, and frankly, they should never have done that.
One of the issues that came up in these hearings, one you hear about a lot on the right, is the idea that, especially with the social media platforms, that they systematically discriminate against conservative points of view, try to suppress conservative messages. And there are different species of this argument. There are some that claim the algorithms are set up in such a way as to suppress conservative content. There's also the issue that you've seen, especially on Twitter, which Twitter wasn't a part of the hearings yesterday, but with them flagging posts, shutting accounts, pulling down content. And Richard, the defender of those platforms will say about the editing, because they don't concede the algorithm point. They'll say, look, it's their company. You know, however they choose to promote content, whatever editorial rules they want to impose, so be it. What's your reaction to that?
This is one of the great problems in antitrust, and it's a very serious question. If you take the traditional American view, if you manage to create a monopoly from scratch without any kind of illicit behavior, and then you exert that quote-unquote monopoly power in the marketplace by the inclusion or exclusion of people, price discrimination, or anything else, we don't worry about it because the primary object of the antitrust law is not to nip the creation of these new companies in the bud, which you can do if you stop them. The intermediate case is you start with one of these companies and then you acquire things by way of acquisitions through mergers or takeovers. And there's a huge fight about that. I think Facebook took over some company called Instagram and so forth. It went through an FCC or an FTC approval hearing. It passed muster. And now people like Tim Wu come back and said they should have never done that in the first place because what they did is they suppressed competition by taking over this behemoth. There's a post-hoc prop-to-hoc problem there because one of the answers you have is, yes, these companies are now behemoths, to be sure, but they had a great idea. If they were left as free companies without the infusion of capital and expertise from the takeover, they'd still be two-bit players instead of major players. And so the choice is not whether or not you have a company as powerful as some of these takeover companies, stay freestanding or subject to ownership. The question is, do you want to have a really powerful integrated company on the one hand, or do you want to have Facebook without the benefit of this particular technology and a very weak competitor that can't get capital? And so what there is always this particular sense of saying that if you look at the success of the company after the merger, you attribute it to all the independent attributes that the acquired company had, when in many cases it's the synergy that started to create that. And that's just one of the kind of sloppy arguments that are made. And so what you really want them to do is to go back over the records at the time that the acquisition were made, look at the arguments and see whether or not they were actually correct. And in some cases it may well be that the FTC was a little bit too lax. In other cases, they may have done it just about right. But what's happening here is it's just simply very sloppy argumentation because you can't figure out whether the gain is properly attributed to the acquisition by the dominant company or whether it's attributed to the intellectual property of the other or what the appropriate mix and those two things turns out to be. The Europeans have a very different view on this, and they don't worry so much about the intermediate case of acquisitions. Their attitude is, I don't care how you got there, I just care where you are now. And if you were sitting here as a dominant player, what we have to do is to sort of regulate you. Now, one of the costs of that position is that if you take this position, you're not going to have any dominant players like this. It is not, I think, a complete accident. There's not a single important tech innovation company that has survived, that has come out of the EU in the last 50 years. These are all American college dropouts or some variation thereof who create all of these kinds of things, because we're in an environment now where you don't stifle them to begin with. You go into the European situation, it's not that they wait until you turn out to be worth $100 billion before they clamp down on you. There are a whole variety of restrictions that come out of the European culture and the European enforcement system that kick in much earlier. So the great contributions that the Europeans have is they apply their various trade laws, Mr. Steger and so forth, against American companies who want to do business there. They don't have to apply it to their own because they've killed them off long before this has happened. And do they do the right thing? Well, my view about it is no. I mean, I've written at great length about some of the privacy policies, about sharing data that come out of the European system. And frankly, I regard these people as just plain bizarre. They do is they have this notion of individual autonomy, which is compromised when you share data with somebody else. It turns out if you do so by contract, it's fine. And then they assume if somebody has on their particular server private and confidential information about you, which they can only access for cause, the mere fact that this stuff is on a server somewhere in the United States or accessible to an American company, that's an invasion of privacy. And the correct way of thinking about this is we need this information for all sorts of purposes. We need it for emergencies. We need it for medical records. We need it for essentially marketing studies and so forth. And if you can find that the actual use of the data does not involve any kind of mistaken behavior, then you start to let it run. And I might also add, if you're starting to talk about privacy, which everybody's worried about in addition to bias, if you create multiple companies and they all have the same information and it gets leaked, in many ways it's harder to regulate because you have no idea which particular company has done. So then what you have to do is you have to decide, well, there's a point, ex post abuse is serious, but if you don't get there, it's not very good. What is it that you want to do to these kinds of companies? And breaking up doesn't work. You mentioned the reason why it cannot be done for a network industry, because what happens in that case is you break it up into two networks and distribute the people 50-50. The total value of the divided system is probably not a 1/2 + 1/2 = 1. It's probably 1/4 + 1/4 = 1/2. So you have a huge amount of wealth loss coming out of it. Then what you try to do is to figure out what you're going to do. Well, you can't use pricing devices in this because essentially these are ad-driven economies in many ways. And in fact, one of the things that happens is the ads drive it. One innovation that I always take advantage of now is you go on many of these shows that you could buy your way out of the ads. So if you want to pay an extra $5 a month, you don't get this scheme. I listen to music all the time on YouTube, and I pay, you know, I don't know, $50 a year not to hear ads in the middle of a Mozart sonata. I regard myself as richer and happier. And these companies will try to do all that. Remember, when there's a monopolist, they don't want to take their money out by putting conditions on customers that hurt the customer more than it helps the firm. What you want to do is to get to the optimal mix of net benefits and then change the price so it's a little bit higher than it would otherwise be. Now, how much higher is a tough question. I remember many years ago, I went to Microsoft, which, you know, they weren't called here this time, but in 1998. And the thing that struck me most when I spoke to their people was that all of them basically lived in mortal fear that the sword of Damocles was about to descend upon their head and to destroy them. Now, I said, why did they do this? See, their attitude was that if these markets have the characteristics that you just mentioned, that is, it's happy to have everybody or you get nobody, they're afraid that they're going to be like one of the many companies that were beaten by Facebook. I don't even remember their names. MySpace, I think, was one of them. What they're worried about is the fact that if they do lose, they will not lose slowly. They will lose discontinuously, and they'll go from everything to nothing. And so what does that do? Well, now, in effect, the analogy is to what Ronald Coase used to call the durable monopolist. And so he used to ask the question, if you have a durable monopoly that is selling goods that will last for a good deal of long time, and you're the only seller, what price do you sell at? And Ronald wrote a famous paper saying, you end up selling at the competitive price because the entry problem is so great to you that you always bid yourself down in that way. And there's a little bit of that going on here. So when they start talking about the antitrust laws, you made, I think, a provocative statement, which I do not regard as correct. I don't attribute it to you, Troy, which is you need a whole new theory to apply to these cases. That's just wrong. It turns out that there's a lot of stuff that is coming from older systems that really worked. There's the durable monopoly list that I just mentioned. There's a huge discussion about the effect of network industries and railroads and telephones, which started to take place at the rise of the Industrial Revolution around 1900. Those problems also had a rate of return regulation in that you don't tend to see in the modern place. And the thing that is so disheartening in many cases is these judges who were deciding these very complicated matters without the benefit of modern economic theory often had better instincts as to how they should be resolved than the modernists today. So, I mean, one book that I'm very critical of, elegantly written, but I think ultimately wrong, is Tim Crew talking about the curse of bigness. That's the worst of Louis Brandeis. You read the book, it's almost unreadable. But on the other hand, Louis Brandeis was the guy who put together the United Machinery deal, which was a vertical integration transaction, which was really flawlessly executed. And he was the one who wrote the opinion about the Chicago Board of Trade, which was one of the great opinions dealing with the question of whether or not certain practices are or are not per se monopoly practices. So, you know, Brandeis, you know, he strikes out one time and he hits two home runs. It's like that all the time. But what's happened is you could learn an enormous amount from this stuff if you want to follow it. And what you do is you come up with the conclusion in these cases, there's no structural remedy. I break up the Yankees, that's going to work. And if you're trying to figure out practice remedies, there isn't a whole of a lot that you can do. I think that the privacy thing is going to be solved by the companies themselves for the most part, if they're allowed to do so. And the occasional action ex post, that is by suit, if in fact you take psychiatric information about somebody's very sensitive position and you give it illicitly to an employer or to somebody like that, I think that that can happen. That has in fact been the way it is done when they put the whole HIPAA regulations in on privacy. If you went back and checked the number of cases of violation, there were a trivial number. You put the regulation in and it basically created huge convulsions with respect to medical records and so forth, all of which have to be used constantly in order to make the system work. And they basically had a presumption that any sharing of medical information was a wrong. Just a big, fat, old mistake. But the political bias problem is, I think, a serious one. I don't think there's any legal remedy to it in the sense of stopping them from doing this. But what I do think is there should be a political remedy. As you indicated, it may well be that Facebook's got a lot of clout, but so then does Fox News and podcasts like this. And frankly, I'm going to slam those guys within an inch of their lives for the way in which I think they start to treat people. And I think that that is actually going to influence the ways in which these things start to work. It's too slow. It's too imperfect. But my view is I don't want the Republicans regulating the Democrats or the Democrats regulating the Republicans. So I just kind of sit here and say, look, this is a bad situation. I don't know how to make it better through collective action. I do want to make it better through criticism. I wish the world that they had invited the Twitter people there so that they could be attacked for the way in which they've excluded folks. But the Democrats, I'm told, wouldn't have them come there because they thought they were too big a department. The argument goes for the Republicans. So look, this is a completely tumultuous space. But what happens is, in order to get any sensible statement about this, what you have to do is you have to take the microscope, and instead of looking at the whole world in one fell swoop, you have to concentrate on particular practices, particular firms, and so forth, and try to get some traditional theory which will help you answer the question as to whether or not the monopoly is driven more by efficiency than it is by restrictions. And that's a question that has been on the books for years and years and years.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas@hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.